Good morning, everyone. As most of you know, my name is Gavin Byrne, and I'm the minister of this congregation. A special welcome to our visitors today. Welcome. Welcome to this place. Whatever path has brought you here, whatever load you carry, let us rest a while together. May our hearts be open to accept what comes to us as a stranger. May our minds be open to wonder at what we do not understand. And may our spirits be nourished by our time here together before we take up again our loads and set off upon our many paths. Welcome. I have some news. Stephen Cleary, a long-time Unitarian and a member of this community, died yesterday at noon, and he was surrounded by his family. And we offer his family our deepest sympathies. Now, Stephen loved his Unitarian identity and was deeply interested, particularly in my journey to ministry. And he was often impatient. He would ask, "Have they ordained you yet?" And he gifted me with a 2-volume history of the Unitarian Universalist movement. He felt it important that his minister understood the breadth and depth of this free and inquiring religion. And of course, it had at its heart the inherent dignity of each and every human being. So we thank you, Stephen, for the life that was yours and for the legacy you have left. Er yesh deg oreva anam, may he rest in peace. Amen. We will, of course, let you know funeral details when they become known. So now let us light our chalice, which is lit everywhere Unitarians gather in prayer, in celebration, in searching, and in love. We light our chalice, symbol of our Unitarian faith, sign of the spark of life in all living beings, fire of commitment to love and to justice. As the chalice cup embraces the flame, may we hold one another in loving community, sharing our gratitude, sharing our pain and our hopes for our world. For we are the co-weavers of the story of the universe, which is a web of intricate connections and infinite possibilities. Now let us sing hymn number 361, Enter, Rejoice, and Come In. Janet has our first reading.
Morning, everybody. I'm following on from a theme that Pamela addressed on Wednesday. She read out part of Eckhart Tolle's book, and she referenced the sacred present, trying to engage with each and every moment as much as we can. Today I'm reading from Walking on Water by Anthony DeMello, and it's a story. My favourite part of this Sunday service is the children's story, so this is another story. I think if I could title it, I'd just title it The Present Moment, The Perfect and Sacred Moment. There was a temple built on the edge of an island, which was around 2 miles offshore. And in the temple, there were 1,000 silver bells, large and small. Bells made by the best artisans in the world. And whenever the wind blew, or a storm arose, the bells chimed. It was said that whoever heard those bells would be enlightened and led into a deep experience of God. The centuries went on, and gradually the temple and the bells sank into the sea. But the traditional belief continued to be that from time to time the bells chimed, and whoever had the gift of hearing them would be transported to God. Attracted by the legend, a young man set out on a journey of many, many miles until he stood looking out over the place where it was said that the temple had stood many years before. He sat down in the first shade he found and began to try to hear the sound of those bells. Try as he might, the only thing he managed to hear was the noise of the waves breaking on the beach or crashing against the rocks. That annoyed him because he was trying to block out that noise so he could hear the bells toll. And so he strove for a week, 4 weeks, 8 weeks. 3 months went by. When he was about to give up, he heard the elders of the village at night speaking about the tradition and about the people who received the grace, and his heart was on fire. But he knew that a heart aflame was no substitute for the sound of those bells. After trying for 6 or 8 months, he decided to give up. Perhaps it was just a legend. Perhaps the grace was not for him. He said goodbye to the people living there and went to the beach to say goodbye to the tree that had offered him shade, and to the sea, and to the sky. While he was there, he began to listen to the sound of the waves and discovered for the first time that it was a pleasing and a relaxing sound. And that sound led him to silence. And as the silence deepened, something happened. He heard the ringing of a tiny bell. He was overwhelmed and he thought, I must be producing that sound. It must be the power of suggestion. Once more, he began to listen to the sound of the sea. He relaxed and he remained in silence. The silence became more intense, and again he heard the ringing of a tiny bell. Before he could even be surprised, another bell rang, and then another, and another, and another. And then a symphony of 1,000 temple bells was ringing in unison. He was transported out of himself, and he received the grace of union with God. So, if you want to hear the sound of a bell, listen to the sound of the sea. If you want to recognize the dancer, look at the dance. And if you want to hear the voice of a singer, listen to the song. Look, listen. Experience what someday will be granted to you to recognize within you.
So to our children's story, our story for children and young people, and for those of us who are young at heart. This is a story about Pip, who was a tiny, tiny tree frog who overcame the impossible. Pip was a tiny tree frog with unusually short back legs, making it completely impossible for him to leap like the other frogs in the whispering forest. And while his brothers and sisters launched themselves across wide rivers to the tops of tall mushrooms, Pip could only manage small, clumsy hops. The elders always said, a frog who cannot leap will never see the great star flower at the top of the canopy tree. The canopy tree was the tallest in the entire jungle, and its peak was considered impossible to reach for anyone who wasn't a master leaper. One evening, the jungle gathered to watch the annual canopy climb. And Pip watched as the strongest frogs took the massive leaps, aiming for the lowest branches. But the wind was howling and the branches were slick from the rain. And one by one, the big leapers slipped and they fell back to the mossy ground, and many just gave up. "It's impossible," they said. But Pip looked at the swirling mist. He knew he couldn't leap to the first branch. But as he looked closely at the rough bark of the giant trunk, he noticed something others had missed. Millions of tiny grooved ridges winding all the way up like a spiral staircase. So Pip hopped to the base of the tree, and instead of coiling his legs to jump, he firmly pressed his sticky toe pads against the bark. He took one small step upward, then another, and then another. The other frogs saw him. "What is he doing? He can't jump that high." But Pip didn't try to jump. He just climbed, one step at a time. And when the wind blew fiercely, the leaping frogs on the lower branches were shaken off. But Pip, he simply hugged the bark tighter, using his low center of gravity to stay secure. And when his legs grew tired, he rested in a small knot in the wood and then just kept going. Hours and hours passed, while the rest of the jungle slept, defeated by the impossible task. Pip steadily moved past the first branch, then the second, then the third, and eventually then he reached the clouds. He focused only on the next inch of bark right in front of his eyes. And then, just as the sun began to rise, Pip pulled his tiny body onto the very highest leaf of the canopy tree. And there, bathing in the morning light, was the magnificent, glowing, great star flower. And Pip looked down at the tiny speck of the jungle floor below. He realized that the task hadn't been impossible at all. The others had just been trying to fly, when all they really needed to do was to take one small step at a time. Story of Pip the Jungle Frog. So with that in our hearts and minds, let us turn now to hymn number 301, "Touch the Earth, Reach the Sky." My reading this morning is entitled "Between Truth and Truth," and it's written by Reverend Philip Waldron, who's a Unitarian minister from Merseyside. Truth sat quietly, not upon a throne, but upon a low stone, worn smooth by the passing of feet and years. Truth did not shine. Truth did not shout. Truth simply was. From the far side of the horizon, knowledge approached, robed in numbers, footnotes, diagrams, its hands full, but its eyes bright with certainty. "I have come to clarify you," said knowledge earnestly. "I have measured the world, tested its edges, named its patterns, and I can make you useful." Truth smiled, small and patient. "You may make me usable," Truth replied, "but do not mistake that for making me whole." Knowledge frowned, for this was not the answer it expected. From the shadows between them, Truth, with a small t, stepped forward, ink-stained, provisional, carrying pamphlets and policies, speaking in confident tones. "I am what the people need," Truth declared. "I am simple enough to hold, clear enough to obey, and stable enough to build upon." Truth looked at truth with tenderness. "You are my child," truth said, "but you are not me." Truth, with a little t, bristled. "But without me, nothing functions. Without me, there is chaos." "Without me," truth replied gently, "there is certainty without wisdom." And at that moment, time arrived. Not walking, not rushing, but unfolding. Time did not speak at first. Time rarely does. When time finally opened its mouth, its voice was layered, young and ancient, urgent and slow. "I have seen this before," time said. "I have seen knowledge crowned, truth legislated, truth ignored. Knowledge stiffened. I am not arrogant," it protested. "I revise myself and I learn." "Yes," said time, "but only when you're allowed to fail," truth shifted uneasily. "And what of me?" it asked. "I keep the world moving." "You do," said time, "but when you forget that you are temporary, you become dangerous." Silence settled between them. Truth rose from the stone, not taller, but clearer. "I do not belong to any one of you," truth said. "I pass through knowledge. I am simplified by truth, and I am revealed slowly by time." Knowledge bowed its head. Truth loosened its grip. Time smiled, which looked very much like patience. And there in that quiet convergence, something shimmered, not certainty, not doubt, but understanding. And may you be blessed as you stand among them, between what is known and what is told, between what works and what is true, not finished, not lost, but becoming. So at this time in our service, we pause and quiet our minds, find a comfortable position, and be held firmly in this place. And if you wish, close your eyes. We will now celebrate the communion of the circle that is our home and our spiritual space. The earth, one planet, round, global, so that when you trace its shape with your finger, you end up where it started. It's one, it's whole. All the dotted lines we draw on our maps of this globe are just that, dotted lines. And they smear easily. Oceans can be crossed, mountains can be crossed, even the desert can be crossed. The grain that grows on one side of the border tastes just as good as the grain on the other side. Moreover, bread made from rice is just as nourishing to body and spirit as bread made from corn, or spelt, or teff, or wheat, or barley. There is no superior land, no chosen site, no divine destiny falling upon any one nation who draws those dotted lines just so. There is only one earth we all share, we, the living, with all else that lives and does not live. Virus, granite, wave, city, cornfield, prophet, beggar, child, slum, tower, mine, robin, eel, grandfather, rose, olive branch, bayonet, and this poem and moment are all within the circle, undivided by dotted lines or final certainties. everything, for good or ill, is part of the shared whole. Sky, earth, song, words, and now this silence. Thank you, Josh, for that beautiful dedication to the life of Glenn Hansard, who graced our streets and homes and souls with beautiful, beautiful music. I titled this address, What Feels Most Impossible Now? And when I did that, it felt impossible to complete it. I thought I would reflect on how we might reconcile some of life's most challenging and often insurmountable aspects. When I was writing this, I found myself considering the idea of human flourishing, a concept that predates the Christian movement. It requires an inclusive and compassionate approach that will transcend divisions and embrace diversity. It has to. Yet the diversity that is human life does create divisions in our society. Not everyone wants this diversity under the piece of sky that they inhabit. What we can do is adopt the practice of solidarity, open-mindedness, and dialogue. The divisions evident in Irish society are perhaps not as divisive yet as they are in other places, perhaps because an identifiable or effective leader hasn't yet emerged. But first, a search, not using an internet search engine or artificial intelligence, but a quiet, courageous search of our own heart will reveal to us what feels most impossible to us today. And whatever it is, you already know it. The heart knoweth. When life presses in and the world feels overwhelming, how do we cope with that weight? There are, of course, resources within, and there we know what matters most. Throughout our lives, we build a foundation that gives our lives meaning and abundance. It is love and friendship, health, community, and all the good things we are graced with each and every day. And these are not small things. They are the bedrock upon which I stand when storms gather. In my address titled Finding Wisdom a couple of weeks ago, I quoted the poet James Stevens, who wrote, "It is the function of the artist to transform all that is sad, all that is ugly, all that is real into one quality which reconciles the diversities that trouble us into pure poetry." And can we in our ordinary lives be that artist? Can we reconcile what Stevens calls the diversities that trouble us? Now, he wasn't talking about the rich diversities of color, of language, of culture, or religion. Those gifts are to be celebrated, and I'll return to speak about these. He was speaking, rather, of the chaotic, seemingly irreconcilable elements of human experience, the tensions between good and evil, joy, sorrow, breathtaking beauty, and raw ugliness. And how do we begin to reconcile these jarring notes of human existence? And to be quite honest with you, at times it feels utterly impossible. Religion. Can religion help navigate what feels impossible? Well, the answer depends entirely on how you might define religion. If religion is understood as a set of rigid, unbending dogmas that divides humanity, then of course not. It only adds to the impossibility. But if we understand religion as the practice of holding certain things in deep reverence, believing them to be sacred, then the answer is different. What we hold sacred springs directly from our lived experience. It is an expression of what is of paramount importance to each of us. And through the shifts and the losses and the triumphs of life, we gain understanding. The meaning and fulfillment we seek are found not in abstract theological formulas, but in the depth and quality of the relationships we build. The sacred is found in the experience of living and moving in this world, in family, in deep friendship, and in the beauty of creation. And for Unitarians, the doorway through which we glimpse the sacred, or that which is of paramount importance, is wide open. It's not dependent on rules or dogmas or religious tests. And part of the core purpose of gatherings like ours is to respond to the universal human longing for kindness, for connection, for meaning, and for purpose. We recognize the profound interconnectedness of life, seeking a more loving way of living alongside one another. Human flourishing, or as my favorite hymn lyric puts it, that all may have abundant life in every earthly nation. It was Aristotle who gave us the notion of human flourishing. He argued that what every human being fundamentally seeks is a deep, lasting sense of well-being. and he called this eudaimonia, or human flourishing. But for this to be achieved, Aristotle believed that all efforts in government, all efforts in life, should be directed towards human flourishing for all. Where I part ways with Aristotle is in his narrow definition of who is eligible. Aristotle was an elitist. He saw no reason to extend this effort to the stranger, to those of lower status than him, or indeed to foreigners. In essence, his ethic was, love your neighbor as yourself, provided your neighbor is of the same social class. Now, tragically, we see this attitude today. We see religious, political, and social movements that preach flourishing, but only for our own, denying basic dignity to the outsider. Yet Aristotle's core intuition, I think, remains sound. All efforts in governance, all efforts in life should be directed towards human flourishing for all. Now, this was, I believe, the thrust of the very early Christian communities, the establishment of the beloved community, all inspired by the stories told about Jesus of Nazareth. So what about living in this diverse world? What feels impossible right now is learning how to live and flourish together in this diverse world. And I believe that diversity is as crucial as gravity, to quote Saville Hicks. Humanity is made up of diversities of color, language, culture, religion, gender, and sexuality. Can we establish a society where everyone, in all their distinctiveness, is afforded the space to thrive and to flourish? We see people taking to the streets with flags, with slogans, with violent words and violent actions to oppose this idea. Live and flourish elsewhere, not here. While physical violence erupts occasionally, more engage in subtle and a toxic war of words, preying on anxieties. And a climate of casual hostility poisons public life and leaves many feeling powerless to respond effectively. People do adopt prejudices, ancient prejudices, declaring that only those who look, who act, who worship and love like them are deserving of our kindness, our welcome and our love. They believe that they have an enemy to defeat. Whatever it may be woke, it may be the EU, the diversity agenda, and everything will be fine again. And what feels quite impossible to me right now is how to deal with the diversities that James Stevens was talking about. Good, evil, joy, sorrow, and the breathtaking beauty of the earth, but also the raw ugliness of human behavior. Now, many protests against diversity focus heavily on gender, sexuality, ethnicity, and nationalism. Consider a protest outside the Dáil earlier in the summer I told you about. Speakers targeted gay people, the trans community, men from the Middle East, and women from Somalia. They held national flags alongside crosses and images of Jesus, appealing to some biblical standard. And in that moment, I wondered, do these people think they're following in the tradition of that great Irish patriot, Daniel O'Connell, who said, "My sympathy with distress is not confined within the narrow bounds of my own green island. No, it extends to every corner of the earth. And I hope including this corner of the earth, Mr. O'Connell." And then what about that biblical standard so many claim to live by? Now, while Unitarians don't hold the Bible to be the absolute rule of life, the text does contain harsh words for those who fail to welcome the foreigner, while condemning those who neglect those struggling with poverty, with homelessness, and with prejudice. It deeply troubles me that we so easily blame those who are vulnerable for our troubles, real or imagined. But there always has been a market for someone to blame. Systematic failure is where the blame belongs, with policy choices, with collective apathy, really at the heart of government where blame lies. Liz Slade is the chief officer of the General Assembly of Unitarian and Free Christian Churches, and she recently reflected on these deep societal tensions. She was addressing a situation where a conference venue in England excluded Unitarian gatherings, stating that their charitable purpose required them to prioritize Trinitarian Christian groups. And because our non-creedal tradition is Unitarian rather than Trinitarian, we were excluded. Fine. We'll be fine. We gather around a shared practice of spiritual discernment rather than a static statement of belief. But this led her then to reflect on the general conflict and tension, particularly when divisions are divisive and seemingly impossible to resolve. She writes, "It feels important to give attention to the voices from all sides in a conflict, to give voice to accounts of devastation and pain that most of us will thankfully not encounter. My conscience tells me that abhorring genocide does not mean I tolerate anti-Semitism or vice versa. When there is no real dialogue, it can be easy for people to feel trapped in narrow binaries. You're either for or against us. It is essential," she says, "in honoring the dignity of the lives of those entangled in the countless years of violence and the intense devastation of recent years, that we make space to bear witness. For Unitarians, bearing witness could mean solidarity. It means standing together across difference and remaining open to learning and investing in relationships even when disagreement runs deep. In her words, it means becoming attuned to hear the truth in unlikely places. Yet this solidarity does have a real cost. It requires us abandoning the comfort of our own tribal echo chamber. Yet it is a genuine expression and an acknowledgement of our shared humanity." My friend and colleague from Unitarian College, Rob Foreman, has also been reflecting on the growing divisions in British public life, and he wrote a public letter to the new Prime Minister, Andy Burnham. He says, "Disagreement has to be survivable. An argument you never lose is an argument you never learn from." His point is, disagreement is not fatal, nor is it an invitation to attack. You can hold a conviction passionately without needing the person opposite you destroyed. It is important for us all to understand that being heard and being agreed with are not the same thing. And those who do feel beaten will escalate the row. The words get bigger and resolution becomes ever more distant. If Unitarianism is a free and inquiring religion, then it means that we approach a question with the assumption that we could be wrong, and that the person arguing across the table from us is arguing in good faith. The point of the conversation is to get closer to something that is true, rather than to win. When I spoke about resolving conflicts a few weeks ago, I wondered if we might approach conflict with a curious mindset, rather than with a defensive posture. Why do they hold that position? Why does it matter to them so much? Because what matters to them may very well be the same as what matters to me. Making time and room to discover these things reveals just how much we actually share, because we all have in our lives things that are of paramount importance, even sacred. And let's begin there, and perhaps we can transform a divided society. And this leads me back then to that anchor point in our lives where we can ground ourselves upon the sacred foundations of our lives: love, friendship, health, community, and the good things we are graced with each day. Facing the impossible begins when we reach for the resources that are within. And anchored in that space, perhaps we can face what feels most impossible and slowly quieten the noise competing for our attention. We can listen to the voice that speaks from the stillness of our hearts. There is deeper truth, and it lies within. It rests not upon an exalted throne, but upon a stone, humble, accessible, and grounded in nature. Truth is not something handed down by an external authority. It is discovered, shaped, and shared by ordinary people walking together through time. We say here that the paths of faith, meaning, and truth runs through many lands, many cultures, and many traditions. But ultimately, truth must find a home and a resting place in our own hearts and in our own minds. So look there first. But as you look inward, remain open to what you might learn when you look out. Amen. Our fourth hymn this morning is hymn number 108, My Life Flows On in Endless Song, after which we will have the collection. Thank you, everyone, for your offering this morning. Thank you to everyone who contributes to making our Sunday services flow seamlessly from door opening to welcoming, from chalice lighting to refreshments and chat downstairs. Thank you all. And you are all invited to join us for tea and coffee downstairs after the service. The next Heart and Soul Contemplative Spiritual Gathering is on Monday, the 17th of August at 7 p.m. in the vestry, and it will be led this month by Maud Robinson. So if you are interested in attending, please contact Maud, and her contact details will be in the weekly newsletter. And if you would like to receive the weekly newsletter, please see Josh after the service. Rory Delaney will lead two city walks in the coming weeks, the 30th of August and the 13th of September. And both walks will start directly after the Sunday service. And details will be in Uskilt. The August edition is on the table outside. But details will also be included in the weekly email. Finally, it is time, I think a lot of you believe, that we regather the Justice and Peace group that was very active in this church in the past. I suggest that those interested, if you would gather directly after the service and put your name and your number on the sheet of paper that I have here. At our AGM in April, we agreed to work on initiatives that promote the right of all people to freedom, to justice, and dignity. We also said that we would support local and global initiatives that use peaceful means to protect and advance human rights, including partnerships with organizations dedicated to this cause. We will support policies that promote equality and justice within our own community and beyond. We will encourage members to actively participate in social justice campaigns and initiatives. So if you're interested in being part of that group, we will take your name and number and take it from there. Thank you. Now let us sing our final hymn, which is 159, This Is My Song. Do not ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. Community is not only where we gather, but how we live when we scatter. It is found in the courage to be ourselves and in the grace to honor the difference in others. The world hungers for leaders who listen, for companions who care, and for neighbors who build bridges. Go then and be alive, For in your aliveness you bring healing, hope, and renewal to the world. Amen.